Let me just start the first thing. I think that the organization of the panel was kind of perfect. And so now we're talking about kind of neighbor definitions. And my work is really talking about amalgamating demography and public health. And so again, we're talking about spatial polygamy among low-income housing residents using GPS methods. First, I want to say that I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. Then I acknowledge my collaborators. So my collaborators include Sean Reagan from NYU, Stephen Matthews and Basile Schaeff from Penn State, and INSERM in Paris, France, respectively. My team of research assistants for this particular project, William Godel, Ta'abe Yoma, who are both RAs and also participate in the paper. And last but not least, the director of the section that I work in, Brian Ebel, who's a key collaborator and colleague on this work. So why neighborhoods? So as a spatial epidemiologist, I can present tons of studies that show that neighbors can influence health and health disparities. But I'll just give one example here. So last summer we conducted this study, and public housing residents talked about their lives to me and my staff. And we got energized or excited to document this through this documentary called Bad Neighbors Affect Your Health, A Story Among Low-Income Housing Residents. And this is just one quote from someone from the documentary said. She stated, "They don't really care about us in the hood." And she's talking about lack of food access in her particular neighborhood. And so George Kaplan, who's a noted social epidemiologist, stated, like real estate, health is location, location, location. Where you live makes an enormous difference. And just to provide a New York City example, since I live and play and socialize in New York, and since this data comes from New York, just to show that this map shows that lower Manhattan, the premature death is lower, and when we get higher in Manhattan and to the Bronx, it gets higher, suggesting the neighbors also influence health. But the question that we kind of alluded to earlier, and that really is seminal to my work, is how we define neighborhood or neighbor definition. And so this is a typology, some of which we discussed, on objective measures of defining neighborhoods, including first-generation measures, such as administrative neighbor definitions, which we've talked about, things like counties and zip codes and census tracts. What I've called Generation Y measures, or current measures, are static egocentric buffers, which I'll describe in a second. And finally, what I think is the wave of the future, or one potential direction, in terms of defining neighborhoods, are GPS-defined activity spaces. So this is an example of a map that my colleagues and I published, where we show zip codes and counties, or boroughs in New York City, as a way to define neighborhoods. And so this is an example of a static egocentric buffer. And essentially, imagine your house, so close your eyes, I'm just kidding, don't close them, but imagine your house and think about maybe a half mile around your house. That could be an example of a static egocentric buffer. So just let's dig into GPS neighborhoods just a little bit so we're all on the same page before I get into the results. So GPS devices essentially allow you to know your latitude and longitude location so you can assess mobility patterns and then create these activity spaces. And so my colleague Basile Schaeff defined the activity space neighborhood as follows. A set of spatial locations visited by an individual over a given period of time, corresponding to his or her exhausted spatial footprint. And so essentially we're talking about common destinations, things like workplaces, grocery stores, and it's really asking the question, where do you spend more of your time? And so the different types of GPS devices are quite pervasive. And some of the GPS devices can be trackers or a cell phone chip in your phone. This is a QSTAR GPS device, which we're using in this particular project and our work. It also happens to be the most common GPS device used in spatial epidemiology research to date. And so essentially with this technology, we're able to not just look at the administrative neighborhood or this ecocentric buffer. We can look at the activity space, and it also can be timestamped. And so imagine from your home to work, you may drop your child off at school, and then back from work to home, maybe you may go grocery shopping to then create dinner for your family that night. And so there's been some work by my colleague Shannon Zink from here in Chicago, actually, who compared GIS neighborhoods and GPS neighborhoods, who's shown that they only share 12% of the variance, suggesting that GIS neighborhoods, or these static egocentric buffers, are really poor proxies of how we define neighborhoods. However, there's this kind of caveat, or this kind of major limitation to research today, which has been termed the residential trap, where the vast majority of research focuses only on the residential neighborhood. And so this is an example from my colleagues Lee and Che in 2011, and they did a review of all studies on neighborhoods and cardiometabolic health. And they found that 90% of those studies focused exclusively on the residential neighborhood environment. And so John Odlin, his term spatial polygamy, this is kind of a light introduction. He was a geographer at Indiana University, and Stephen Matthews, again, is a close colleague at Penn State University, that really talked about this idea of spatial polygamy. So what is it? It's the idea that we live, work, play, and do errands and shop in different neighborhoods. And these different experiences can influence our health. It also kind of argues that not just these distinct locations may matter for your health, but these connections, which we call the community corridor. So this is a paper, for example, where we've shown that youth access to convenience stores are quite frequent in their home and their school neighborhoods, but also in the path between their home and school. So what's the evidence about spatial polygamy? So this is an example from the well-known Los Angeles Family and Neighborhood Survey, and they showed that only 22 participants grocery shopped within their own census tract, 42% shopped at an adjacent census tract, and 37 beyond surrounding census tracts. This is one example from my work, where the main finding is that this sample of men affects with men, 75% did not reside, socialize, and have sex within the same neighborhood, meaning that they were quite spatially polygamous, put differently. And so the limitations of overall work on spatial polygamy are as follows. While incredibly helpful, most of the studies are qualitative in nature, and then secondly, most of the studies use survey-based methods. So the aim of this particular study was to examine spatial polygamy among a sample of low-income housing residents in New York City using GPS and related survey measures. Why public housing residents and low-income people in general? Well, they experience health disparities, which is well-known, including, I'm just highlighting two examples here, obesity to hypertension, excuse me. And so we used data from the NYC Low-Income Housing Neighbors and Health Study, which is a sample of 120 public housing residents, 80% of which lives in public housing. And so essentially we went to different public housing developments and gave them this flyer. One of my students over there did that and said, hey, take this survey. People said yes. And the eligibility criteria was as follows. I'm not going to read it all here. You can see on the slide, but being low-income, reading and writing English, and no self-report restrictions to usual physical activity. The GPS protocol that we developed was kind of standard. We asked them to wear it in all journeys, to charge it daily, and to use a travel diary. So this is a picture of the kit, including things like the GPS device and different documents. And again, we gave them this for sure so they understand what it was. And then we gave them a travel diary to really increase compliance of our protocol. And so this is just some sample demographics of the overall sample. Most of the sample was racial minority, as you see there. It's about 70% black. And of course, not surprisingly, by definition, most of the people, 70%, had a household income of less than $25,000. And also a little caveat where we see that most of the sample was from Manhattan. And this is because we predominantly sampled from Manhattan. And so it is just important to briefly show that we published this paper showing that adhering to our protocol was pretty good, i.e., put differently, our GPS data was of high quality. And so this is a map that shows the GPS tracks of one particular participant in our published paper over a week's time. And so this particular study, of the 120 people, we had about 85% who were in our analytic sample. So for example, we excluded six people who didn't have any GPS data and five people who were away from New York City the entire time, thinking that maybe this is not representative of their average week. And so we assessed spatial polygamy in the two following ways, one by GPS and one by survey. In GPS, particularly, we looked at the average number of census tracts and zip codes that the participants' activity spaces intersected, and then we quantified the time spent within residential neighborhoods and away from them, as defined by a quarter and a half mile GIS buffer, respectively. And then finally, we created this survey, including things like, would you consider your neighborhood where you live to be different from the one where you work and go to school? The response options were simply yes and no. So this is just one of two maps that I'm going to present. This is a map of showing the GPS tracks of a participant, their different 400 and 800 meter buffers, and you see their zip code. And this kind of map kind of suggests that there's spatial polygamy, i.e., you see several of these orange dots outside of their home neighborhood. So more specifically, we found the following. The half-mile buffer was about 23 square miles, where the activity or GPS-based buffer was much larger, about 240 square miles. And this is the average for the overall sample, indicating there's a lot of mobility. Also, we see that the participants come from 26 zip codes, in 37 census tracts. However, we found GPS data in 199 zip codes and almost 1,200 census tracts. So one could argue, this is really great, Dustin, and I think that there may be some indication of spatial polygamy. But in this sample of 102 people, maybe one participant went really crazy that week and just kind of traveled all around. And so I'm going to show you a box plot to allay those concerns. And so this shows that this is not one participant that's really driving this result, that there is variation in our sample in terms of how much time they spent within the census tracts, their zip codes in this case, and away, and overall. And so our GPS findings pair quite nicely with our survey findings. And I'll just give you one example here. Again, we asked, would you consider the neighborhood where you live to be different from the one you work and go to school in? Where 75% almost said that they do. And this goes down the line of different aspects of spatial polygamy that we assessed. So I'll just discuss some limitations. One, reactivity bias. Two, GPS data loss. And three, the convenient sample that we had to use. So one, imagine the case that you know you're being tracked for a week and you may change your spatial patterns. So in our actual feasibility study, we asked people, did this change your spatial patterns? And 99% of people said no. So we're not terribly concerned about that. All right, about GPS data loss. So particularly in a city like New York, people are on the subway and they travel underground. And so there's going to be GPS data loss. However, there's really little that we can do about it, and we're really interested in spatial patterns above ground. And finally, the convenience sample. That's definitely a concern, but there's really nothing we can do in this particular case. But we do think that it's a meaningful contribution to the literature, as we think this is the first study to do this. And so the overall conclusions are as follows. Our findings highlight that significant spatial polygamy among our sample of low-income housing residents. And number two, when studying neighbors in health, including among low-income populations, researchers should probably consider beyond the residential context, which potentially could help us understand or reduce health disparities. So this is a picture when we were ending our project. We were particularly excited, a lot of work. And just overall, that my work and others shows that neighbors matter, that we need to invest in neighborhoods. But I think that not just that we need to invest in neighborhoods, we need to invest in various neighborhoods and really think about this idea of spatial polygamy when doing this work. Finally, let's thank the funders, our Clinical and Translational Research Sciences Institute, which funded this project, and then the Health Disparity Low Repayment Program, which allows me to conduct this kind of work. Thank you. And if you have any questions. Yes. Yeah, so we haven't done those analyses yet. We're doing this set of analysis with a different data set, a sample of young men and associated with men, and we are in that sample looking at, for example, the HIV prevalence in different neighborhoods as defined variously. So we're starting to think about those kind of analyses. This paper we're submitting soon, and then we're going to do more stuff like that. Yes, sir? Can you ask the question differently? Are you asking that?
Sure. Well, yeah, I thought in particular, collecting data where people go all the time.
Yeah.
Right? And now we put out calls saying, how can we use our platform to collect data?
Okay.
So it seems like you could do this on a larger scale. You could figure
okay,
out
I'm
where
serious.
People live. And what is true in Manhattan, it's true across the country where people
yeah.
live, where kind of defining neighborhoods.
So yeah, I think I plan to do in the audience because that's kind of our next project that we're planning. So this summer we conducted a small pilot study to, among other things, look at spatial mobility using different methodologies. So in this particular project, we use this kind of dedicated GPS device, but in the next project we use the people's actual cell phones. And so we actually can, by using those methodologies, we can actually probably get larger sample sizes and also get someone's actual spatial mobility. So for example, it's your actual cell phone, so you're probably less likely to perhaps change your spatial patterns, whereas if you're using this kind of dedicated device, you may be thinking about it a little bit, although our work shows not so much the case. So yes, we are thinking about implementing those kind of methodologies and definitely doing this work with larger samples. This was a smaller sample size because it was really a pilot project to kind of test the methods and to kind of think about these kind of conceptual ideas, whether they existed or not. Yeah, Michael. First question again, I remember the second
one. Ethics and privacy.
Yeah, so we have this paper that looks like it's going to come out soon, where we created a map of a sample of men and sorts of men using GPS data, and the reviewer said, I'm really concerned about showing this data. And we also said, well, in a city like New York City, in this particular context, in the particular zip code that we showed the participant's address, or the participant's spatial patterns, there was 80,000 people. And so we're not terribly concerned about that, but we are thinking more rigorously about the privacy concerns. So I can't really answer that beyond us thinking about it and being really rigorous in our kind of methodologies, and also internally. So for example, we're giving our data to different people to analyze, so for example, like our GPS analyst, and we're making sure we're using secure platforms, which is something that we think is really important that people don't really talk about in their work. The sampling piece, that's an excellent point. So we chose a week because it was a standard, and we wanted to use the standard, but our upcoming work is going to really push the envelope to look at more kind of nuances, including longer time spans, so to be more representative of someone's actual spatial patterns. But in terms of where the science is, I would say that we really don't know if a week is an indicator of someone's average spatial mobility versus 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month and over time. I don't think we really have the data yet, but I think that those are forthcoming from my group and others. I would say that our conceptual model here is really that the vast majority of work focuses on this one context, which is where you live, and we've kind of empirically showed, and there are more nuances to the actual paper. For example, we integrate some social network stuff in there, we look at differences by health, et cetera. But the overall kind of idea was that people do experience these different neighborhoods, and so we should study these different neighborhoods. And I think that your question is a really appropriate one, in that I think that we don't really know, because, again, most of the work focuses on one neighborhood. So our next generation work is to kind of link these activity-based neighborhoods to a myriad of health outcomes. And so we have some things that we're planning right now, but nothing published. Yeah. Yeah, if I hear your question correctly, I think you're asking like more about our protocol. So we, and if not, I'll answer, then please ask again or refrain.
I think more for the analysis part.
So one, the first thing we did was we really tried to highlight to our participants overall that they should wear the GPS device as much as possible. And we also were very clear that we can't see where they're going in real time. So it's not really a real-time methodology, although there are real-time methods to use GPS, but we didn't do that. And so one thing that we particularly did is we allowed them to not just wear it on their hip, which is common. So I just came back from Paris, where my close colleague there, he has people wear this kind of machine on them, and we felt like with this population that wouldn't fly at all. And so we allowed them to wear on their hip if they want to, but also to put it in a bag or their pocket. And so by that, we think that people were more adherent to it. The second part of your question?
Just in terms of how do you quantify the missing data from when, I know people, the GPS battery or stuff, and yeah. Things like people leave at home, you know.
So when the GPS data was stagnant for too long, we didn't include it as missing. And for our study, I believe we included, you had to at least wear 1 hour for each of the 7 days, which is a low bar. So in our other work, we're showing that we want ultimately people to wear it 12 hours a day. But this kind of work, we think that is really an underestimation of spatial polygamy, quite frankly. There's probably more spatial polygamy going on when we have kind of more comprehensive, nuanced GPS data, i.e. the entire sample wearing it for at least 8 hours. But in terms of the threshold that people use, my sense is that it's not standard yet. Some people have used one threshold, which is a low bar in this particular study. Some people have used 5, 8, and 12. And we've discussed that in some of our work. Yes?
Questions regarding research and designs of neighborhood effects in social epidemiology. Let's just accept your premise that there are these, neighborhood.
Activity-based neighborhoods?
Yes. So, in social epidemiology, you've got multi-level models. In order to disaggregate, if you will, neighborhood effects from individual effects. So, and you think of it, and we discuss your critique that it's old science to define neighborhoods in that way, that it's residential. So now you introduce the idea that if a real neighborhood isn't a residential neighborhood, it happens to be the aggregate state that you happen to go to. And we're going to use this device to measure and create a virtual neighborhood, at the individual level. So just follow me here.
I'm following.
An individual, your data set now, will represent a new construct of what a neighborhood is. But it's based on individuals moving around.
That's right.
The social equity is that if you live in four places, there's a four-place effect in terms of your health. You individually may have health buffers, or you may not have health risks that are individual, but your place-related vector, So what we've done is really scrambled this whole construct because, what we get into a solicitous situation of where,
couple things. So there's a really good commentary by my colleague Basil Shea in Health in Place, and he actually talks about these issues explicitly. I'd also say that this isn't actually new. This has been in geography for 30 plus years. Essentially what I've done, and my colleagues have done, like Michael Kramer, we've just kind of done arbitrage. So we've kind of borrowed these methods that we think are perhaps useful in geography, particularly transportation geography, and move them in the field of social spatial epidemiology. Then I would say that also the idea of multi-level models is important, but that's really only when you're interested in, or the neighbor definitions or administrative neighborhood definitions, which aren't frequently as done to date. So most of the work done to date is using these ecocentric buffers. And because each person represents their own neighborhood, there's no kind of second level effect, or third or fourth, et cetera. So there's not really a need for that in that sense. And so essentially what people are doing right now are a lot of kind of spatial statistics, or accounting for the spatial autocorrelation, which some of my colleagues talked about. Then secondly, the major issue beyond that, which I didn't talk about, is this idea of spatial misclassification and a lot of the assumptions that we think about these, even these GIS buffers. And so I can think about my neighborhood in New York City. So one real example from my life. I live on 29th and 3rd, and I tend to go south, and I tend to go east. So if you create this GIS buffer of my neighborhood and my exposures, you're missing this whole area that I don't go north and east is not really representative of my particular life, because I don't experience those neighborhood exposures. And so this methodology is kind of, it's not new, but it's just helping us think more rigorously about how we define neighborhoods. And the overall activity space is just one way to do that. I would say it's a particularly it's a crude way to do it. We can think about the time spent into different GPS buffers and then create different sub-neighborhoods. These are things that we're all playing with. At this point right now, we're just kind of representing or showing the kind of early stage work. I would say this is kind of it's still first generation measures of GPS neighborhoods, if you will. And the field is really open. But I especially encourage you to look at the review by the commentary of my colleague, Basil Shea. It discusses these issues explicitly, and I think it rather eloquently talks about the causation issue, which I think is really real in this particular case. I can't respond other than saying thank you. Thank you.